This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Having a child with a physical or learning disability is not easy. And when that child gets older and it's time to enroll them in school, the road does not get any smoother.
I wanted parents to have a comprehensive resource so they felt like they had an advocate with them.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a special ed teacher who just published a book that parents can use as a roadmap for their child's education. Then we'll hear the story of a high school in New York City that helps students who have dropped out get back in and stay there. And we'll spend an academic minute helping people who get so tired of waiting. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you know what a BIP or an SST or even an FAPE is off the top of your head, well done. These are all acronyms used by educators when putting together an individual education plan for a disabled child. And just so you know, that's an IEP. Chrissy Kahn has navigated this letter salad as both an educator and a parent. She's an elementary school assistant principal in the Baltimore, Maryland School District. She's also the IEP chair in her school, as well as the CEO of her own publishing company. Her new book, called Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability, does just that, provides a roadmap through all the jargon and programs you need to navigate when your child enters school. I asked her why she thought to write all this down.
This idea really came, it was inspired by the fact I have been an IEP chair for 9 years, and so I've always been on the other side of the table facilitating getting kids appropriate services and identification. And then when I attempted to foster to adopt two amazing little girls, they both had disabilities, and I had to be on the other side of the table as a parent trying to get my then 5-year-old the right services she needed, and realized, you know, even though I had experience, it's totally different when you're on the other side. And I wanted parents to have a comprehensive resource so they felt like they had an advocate with them without having to hire multiple attorneys and outside sources.
Well, the book comes in 3 parts, and I will tell you, as a parent myself, the first part, the glossary of educational jargon, is worth the price of admission right there. This is pretty This is pretty thorough. It is, and it does help a lot.
And you know what's so funny is a lot of educators, you know, like I put in there, you know, we act like we know all those terms, and we don't always know all those terms.
And probably the most important one, and you've used it already, is IEP. Tell us what that is.
Yes. It is an individualized education plan, and so that really is for students who have a disability. You know, you're always asking to identify them 3 questions. Are they significantly below grade level, 1 to 2 years? Do they need specialized instruction? And so that would be in the form of this big comprehensive plan that has identified goals for them based off of their areas of weakness. And then do they have significant interfering behaviors? And so those are always the questions we're looking at when we're considering this large plan for a child.
When you are making up these plans, are you dealing with just federal rules, or is this a patchwork of states type of thing?
It's really both. And it depends on, you know, your state system, the layout. However, in part 2 of my book, I do include the process. And so every IEP has to have specific components. And I put that in there. So that's like their present levels of performance. We also always have to have like recent assessment data. You know, we always have to have the different parts I put in there and the people. And really, parent is such an important part of these team meetings. They should really feel like they're partners, and it can be really overwhelming looking at these documents. So I want to make sure they have an understanding of what should be in their child's IEP, no matter which state they're in.
Make a good point, because you're sitting in this meeting with a group of highly, you know, competent individuals, one would hope, who know all these terms and know what's going on.
Right.
You're sitting there going, wait a minute, slow down.
Right. Right. This is over my head. And, you know, that's why it's so important for the school to make the parent feel like a partner, because even though, you know, you have all these trained people sitting around the table, the parent is the one that knows their child the best. They are the expert on their child. So we can have all this terminology, but at the end of the day, this paperwork is supposed to represent everything their child needs. And we really need to bring that parent in, make them feel welcome, make it not be over their head, and really hear their expertise on how we can help their child.
Well, we talked about the team. Who is on that team? Who are the players?
So the players are always like a facilitator. And so in my role, I'm the assistant principal and I run the meetings. There are one teacher or more than one teacher, depending on the school, the parent. Usually I have the guidance counselor there along with special educators. It can be one or two, depending on the school. If appropriate, the school nurse is sometimes present. We also have a school psychologist, and that's something not a lot of parents are aware of. So we are able to do our own testing within the school, so parents don't have to spend large amounts of money outside of it. You know, we can do assessments through the school setting. And then depending on if there is a need in regards to speech language, we might have the speech language pathologist there. Or if there is a concern with fine motor, like handwriting, we would have the occupational therapist there. So it's a lot of people.
You speak about the psychologists. Now, you're in a fairly big city school system. When you talk about rural school districts, they probably don't have all those resources, do they?
They might not, although they should within the county. So if they don't have someone specifically assigned to their school, they definitely should have someone in the county office who, if a parent, you know, shares a need, they need to request that that person comes and hears the concern so they can still get the appropriate testing.
Okay. Now, the third part of your book, you talk about different disabilities, and they vary from autism to traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. And are there different ways of navigating different disabilities?
Absolutely, there are. And so I really put in the most common disabilities I see in the general education inclusion setting. So in my school, we don't have what I call self-contained programs. And we do have to accommodate all those needs. You know, I have students with all those labels in my school setting now. And so we have to, you know, work together, the teacher, the special educator, to make sure they're getting what they need in the classroom and for testing.
When you are approached to start helping a child, where does that first approach usually come from? Is it the parent? Is it a physician or pediatrician? Is it just a teacher saying this kid might need help?
Mm-hmm. It usually varies. Normally, I would say it would probably be a teacher. You know, you have a conference, you should have a conference. First and foremost, discuss the child's progress. And then if the concern continues to grow, then we want to go to this step, and a parent can request this, or a teacher, or the school can start this process. In my county, we call it a student support team meeting, and so it's the same members of the team as the IEP meeting. And we come together, and we hear whatever the concern is, and then we all work together to identify appropriate interventions. So what do we think could help this child in this area? So if it was reading, you know, do they need a more specialized group with the reading specialist? And so that would be an intervention we would try for at least 4 to 6 weeks to see if that child made progress with it, and then we would come back to the table.
I imagine, and this is just off the top of my head, that if a teacher in the school would come to that conclusion, there may be parents who say, no, not my kid. They don't need help.
Right. And you are correct. And so that's where we always have, you know, data to support our concern, which can be, you know, informal observations. It can be classwork. It can be work samples. Again, we want to bring the parent in, and I think sometimes it feels like you have these people around this table who are just saying negative things about your child, but we want them to understand we know their child, so getting that parent to understand we see the positives as well as these areas of concern, and then a lot of times parents don't understand the type of interventions we can put in place and that we're there not to blame or criticize, but we're not doing our job if we're not supporting them. So if we have this area of concern, here are all the resources we have that can help your child, and getting them to see that from that perspective is critical in getting the student the right intervention.
I wonder, does it happen the other way around, that a parent says, my kid needs some help, and the teachers and the school says, no, they're really doing okay?
Yes. It absolutely happens the other way around, and that is why it's also so important to hear the parent who is the expert. And I can tell you, especially in the area of anxiety, you know, you will have a child and the teacher does not hear the same concerns because that child is perseverating in their mind all day long over their worries, over their concerns. And on the outside, it seems like, you know, they're doing fine, there isn't a problem, and then they go home, and because they feel more comfortable at home with their anxiety, completely unload on the parent and hate school and this, that, and the other. And so then the parent is very, very concerned and wants to get them the support. So it's really important to hear from the parent's perspective their concerns and then take a closer look at what could be going on with the child with the resources around the team.
Well, in the end, what do you hope parents get out of this book?
I really want parents to feel like they have an advocate at their fingertips, because being a parent is hard enough, especially when you have a child with a disability. You don't have time to be on the internet researching all these things. I ultimately would love it if more schools and parents work together in collaboration to just help the child, because that is what it's about. I want every child, no matter what their disability is, to be successful, and every family to feel supported by the school. It's quite lofty.
It is. It is. If nothing else, they'll come out of it knowing what PLAAFP means.
That's right. Plaf page. Yes, absolutely.
How did you say that?
Plaf.
Plaf. Okay, fine.
Present levels.
Well, then I'm looking in. That means there must also be a FAPE.
Yes. Free appropriate public education.
All right. I'm not going to quiz you anymore. Again, the name of Chrissy Khan's new book is Roadmap to Navigating Your Child's Disability. It's published by her own King Khan Publishing. Still to come, students who drop out of high school in New York City have options for getting back in the game. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. For students who have tried high school but could not stay on track, New York City has options. One of them is a transfer school called West Brooklyn Community High School. Public radio station WNYC in New York spent some time in that school a few years ago, studying methods teachers and administrators use to help prevent students from dropping out. As Beth Fertig reports, a big part of the job is just getting students into the building each morning and keeping them there.
One of the most striking things about West Brooklyn Community High School is the welcome party outside its doors each morning.
Chill out, bro.
Let's go.
The school has 7 counselors who are each responsible for 30 students. Because these kids have a history of not exactly showing up for school in the past, the counselors don't want them hanging around the street. School is supposed to start at 9, says Counselor Aimee Hernandez.
I would say half of my 30 tend to show up after 9:30, and half of them would show from 9:15 to 9:30. Hi, Eric. How are you? It's nice to see you.
Hernandez parks herself inside the front doors of the school, ready to pounce when she sees one of her students. Like the other counselors, she uses an iPad to keep track of who's here and who's not. Only one of her students showed up before 9.
I'll see you later.
Text me with the number.
I'm gonna text you.
At around 9:15, Michael Richman enters the building. He's 19 years old, and he's missed a few days of school recently.
He's a young person that's had difficulty staying in school, and he made the attempt to come back and stay in school. He has a hard history.
She pauses to welcome another boy.
I need to talk to you at some point today. All right, as he walks away. So he's made a point to stay in school, but he's one that needs, like, a lot of support. So.
The counselors stay on top of the kids in different ways. Some make wake-up calls or send text messages reminding kids of their appointments. Sure. Hernandez makes a note to check with Michael later that day about why he's missing school. This highly personalized approach is central to the school's philosophy. The 216 students at West Brooklyn all tried at least one other high school before transferring here. But don't ever tell Principal Gloria Rosario this is a last-chance school.
I hate last chance. I even don't like second chance because it kind of puts this we have limits on chances.
That's why West Brooklyn has the counselors, to make kids feel supported. They're effective, too. Attendance is good for a transfer school. It was 75% last year, and this year's goal is 78%. Counselors meet together on a regular basis to review which students need help.
Some kids come to us failing one region 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, so they know this is my struggle, so you need to help me.
The school is structured so students can earn more credits each year than at a typical high school, and classes are small. But for these students, schoolwork is often the least of their problems.
So how can you focus on your academic work if you don't have a stable place to sleep at night, or if you have mental health issues, or if you have substance abuse issues?
The counselors are equipped to recognize these problems and often direct the students to professional help. This constant balancing act between attending to the students' academic and emotional needs makes West Brooklyn a very busy place.
What is the O for?
Is that it? Oxygen, O2, yeah.
It's about 10 a.m., and I've stopped by a science class in order to check in with Michael Richman. He's the student we met at the door who recently skipped a few days. Right now, he's working with a partner using neon-colored modeling dough to illustrate photosynthesis.
I'm 19. Okay. I shouldn't be here. I should have graduated already.
He feels like he shouldn't be here. Richman was hoping to have graduated in June. But he admits he's been missing too much school because of his job. He works part-time hauling audio equipment around for a DJ company that handles parties.
Well, Fridays and Thursdays, there's parties occasionally, so I was missing a lot of those days, and it just kind of, like, added up. And so now I'm back, ready to do my thing, you know.
Did you have a little talk with somebody?
Well, I talked to my grandmother. She was like, you know, school is important, and this job is temporary. It's not even a lot of money. She really got to me. She got to me.
While we're talking, there's constant turnover in the room. Some kids are just getting to school, but others drift out because they have appointments with their counselors. The counseling office is rarely empty. Some kids come by to explain why they've been absent. One boy admits it's because of a new girlfriend. Others come in to talk about which classes are difficult. The counselors also watch out for any disputes. Kids are thrown out for physical fights, so if a couple of students get into a bad argument, they must go to mediation, says Counselor Antonio Morales.
First, we speak to each student separately, and we have a conversation with them to see, okay, what happened. Usually, they'll write a statement about what happened after they explain to us what happened, and we kind of have them see it in a different way. Because they, you know, they're adolescents, so they don't know. They can't see, like, the way we might see it as adults because things are not objective. They feel everything.
The advocate counselors technically work for Good Shepherd Services, a nonprofit agency that partnered with the school. But they're considered essential to the education process. They don't just keep the peace and corral kids into the school. They keep them here.
You think it's like a special ed class or anything?
No.
It's not a special ed class?
No, it's not.
It's a literacy class.
A new student has come into the counseling office. She doesn't want to go to her literacy class, and Counselor Jermaine Pena is trying to change her mind.
What is that?
English. Literacy.
What is literacy?
The girl has black hair and long orange fingernails. She's defiant, refusing to go because she thinks it's a special ed class. Pena looks up the word literacy in a dictionary for her to read.
Isn't that to learn how to read and write?
There you go!
How to read and write.
Yes, but this is to support you. So you can be an excellent reader. So you can read books like this.
He points to a shelf full of books. Then he escorts her out of the office, and they head together to the classroom.
Do you have a moment of your time?
Pena asks the teacher if she can come outside briefly to meet the new student. She does, and proceeds to gently tell the teenage girl about the literacy class.
As you can hear from the laughter, everybody's having fun. That's not what you're used to. I would say give it a try.
A few minutes later, the girl agrees to go into the room. Another student has been sent to class, and hopefully she'll keep going for the rest of the year. For WNYC, I'm Beth Fertig.
This is nothing like what you've ever had.
Yeah,
it's going to be an experience.
This report is part of American Graduate, a public media initiative addressing the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So is this you? Do you get so tired? Tired of waiting? Well, if so, cheer up. Relief is on the way. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Does waiting make you stressed? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Kate Sweeney, associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of California, Riverside, looks into how to chill out while waiting for potential bad news.
Many of life's most significant and stressful events involved waiting for some kind of news. We wait for news from job interviews, college applications, professional and academic evaluations, and medical tests, among countless other examples. Most people find these experiences challenging, fraught with worry and sleepless nights. And earlier research from my lab revealed that many of the ways we try to cope with uncertainty are ineffective at best. So how can people find some relief in these uncertain moments? The idea of mindfulness, an active focus on the present moment, could be the answer. Waiting is characterized by the worst kind of mental time travel, obsessing about the past and the future. What could I have done differently, and how might things turn out? Mindfulness seemed like the perfect antidote to these repetitive, worrisome thoughts. To test this idea, my colleague Jennifer Howell and I ran two studies with law graduates who were awaiting their results on the California bar exam. This waiting period is particularly torturous because it lasts 4 long months and has significant consequences for the lives and careers of those who endure it. In both studies, we asked participants about their thoughts and feelings throughout the waiting period. In one of the studies, we also assessed their typical levels of mindfulness. And in the other study, we instructed some participants to do a brief mindfulness meditation each week while they waited. In both studies, mindfulness helped people. They reported coping better with their uncertainty, and they managed their expectations more effectively, maintaining a more positive outlook a bit longer than they otherwise would have. Better yet, mindfulness meditation was most helpful for those who typically find uncertainty to be most stressful. We hope our findings can provide a practical strategy for making waiting a little easier.
That was Kate Sweeney of the University of California, Riverside. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.